together. We are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather.
Well, so much for a dramatic opening. Let's try that again. Hobday's theme has just faded out very slowly, and over that you heard the following.
The hour of the wolf is the hour between night and dawn. It is the hour when most people die, when sleep is deepest, when nightmares are most real. It is the hour when the sleepless are haunted by their deepest fear, when ghosts and demons are most powerful. The hour of the wolf is also the hour when most children are born. Of madness, and masks hide behind faces. The hour of all final moments.
Thank you. This is Hour of the Wolf. Welcome. It may be the last Hour of the Wolf. It might not be the last Hour of the Wolf. We really don't know, actually, here at WBAI. I'm with Jim Freund. This is Margo Adler, the once upon a time creator of Hour of the Wolf many, many years ago. And as I listen to this wonderful theme from Silent Running, a theme that I actually still love after 38 or whatever this is years. I love this theme. Welcome, and we're going to have a really fun time, Jim and I, today.
Stay tuned.
Let him know. hat, I will wear the green willow and all around my hat for a 12-month and a day. And if anyone should ask me the reason why I'm wearing it, it's all for my true love, who's far, far away. All around my hat, I will wear the green willow, and all around my hat, for a 12-month and a day. And if anyone should ask me the reason why I'm wearing it, it's all for my true love, who's far, far away.
Well, you know, we're going to have to play the favorites this morning. And that's certainly one of them. And you can, well, just imagine that we were singing along here.
We definitely were.
Actually, I opened the mic for a moment.
No, did you really? Oh, my God.
I really did. So now people on the listening to the webcast are going to have to, like, you know, go back on their players and hear the first chorus. The first chorus is where it turned it on. But you still have a great contralto.
Oh, well, who knows? I haven't had much chance to use it, but, you know, it's here.
So for those listeners who don't know what's going on, let me explain. Big program changes are afoot here, or another appendage, if you like, at WBAI, all going into effect this coming Monday, wherein Gary Null will be coming back and other programming that we can't yet talk about should be announced next week.
But you don't really know. But no one really knows a lot of the stuff yet, right?
Well, there's a grid that has been presented to the staff. And people know about their individual things. There is a grid, yeah. I mean, we do know. I don't know that it's online yet.
But you don't know.
Well, there's the thing. I do know. But I know that it's going to change. But let me just explain that on Halloween, on Sunday, October 31st, I got a phone call from Tony Bates, interim program director of WBAI, and Berthold Reinhardt, who I met actually on Hobte's show, very nice man, who's the interim station manager of WBAI. And they say, well, you know, the ratings at WBAI are not good. The station has been underperforming. A lot of changes are going to be made, and your show is affected. And basically, the show in this time slot, I was told, is going away in this time from 5 to 6 a.m., according to The Grid. R. Paul Martin with Back of the Book and Pickles of the North, of course. And that's Sharon Martin. And Sydney Smith with Carrier Wave. As they alternate now, they're currently on Sundays. We'll be moving here, but only for 1 hour. Then from 6 to 7 a.m. is a Spanish language program. And then I'm currently scheduled to be on from 7 to 8 a.m. in time slot. That would be two-thirds of As I Please with Simon Lokely. Now, Simon is on suspension. He will be brought back. And I suspect, he said, talking out of turn, that Simon will probably end up on Saturday at 7 a.m. where he currently is, but as a time slot that was offered to me. So I think I'm going to be moved, but I don't know where, don't know when. But I also believe that there is good faith in the people who are making these changes. And so I believe I will end up somewhere good. I will call the show wherever I end up Hour of the Wolf, because after 38 years, 36 with me and 2 with Margot Adler, it's branded. And even though, as you heard from the trailer of the Ingmar Bergman film, Hour of the Wolf is the time between night and dawn, Even if I end up doing a show at bleeping 12 noon, where Gary Null is going to be, or something like that, I've got to call it Hour of the Wolf because it's who I am.
Now,
or it'll be an Hour of the Wolf production or
now,
something.
Now, wait a minute. I did Hour of the Wolf until 77.
No, you didn't. You did.
I didn't?
No. You started Hour of the Wolf in January 1972.
Exactly.
Then you went to Clarion in 1974.
But that was just for a month.
That was 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
When you came back, you took 7 to 9 a.m.
Oh, you're right. You're absolutely right. You're right. You're absolutely right.
And that was, was that already Unstuck in Time? No, you had a different name.
Unstuck in Time. Actually,
so
there was a period.
Now,
there was a period of time where I also did Midnight to Something. It was
That's
called
right.
The Far Side of the Moon, it was called. And I did that for like a year.
Yes, and then I did that.
Right. And then, anyway.
I was doing.
So, but let me tell you.
For you everywhere.
Well, let me tell you the story of how Hour of the Wolf came to be. Actually.
First, introduce yourself. Let the one person listening who doesn't know who you are.
Okay, so my name is Margot Adler, and right now I'm a correspondent at NPR, and I'm also the author of some books about Wicca and goddess spirituality, and also I've written a 60s memoir called Heretic's Heart, and this book on paganism and nature religions is called Drawing Down the Moon, and I've done a whole bunch of stuff. And I started out at WBAI in 1968. And the story, I might as well even tell, since we have all this time, I'll tell you the whole story. So I actually started out in Pacifica at KPFA in 1968, and I was a senior in college, had no idea what I was going to do with my life.
Berkeley.
This was in Berkeley, and KPFA is in Berkeley. And I had no idea I would end up as a journalist. I was in the typical, I'm a senior, what am I going to do with my life? And I actually took that test, you know, the famous test that you take where you answer 300 questions, you know, would you rather pick carrots or file cards? And you answer, 300 questions like this. And then you come out, they give you a little list of all the things that you, how you fit compared to other people who are in these various professions. And most of my friends, got forest ranger first and things like that. But I came out with all the things that I had rejected in my life. So I come from this psychiatric family. So, of course, number one and number two were psychiatrists and psychologists. And I was a singer, a voice student at the High School of Music and Art. And then, this is now LaGuardia. And and the second two were musician and music teacher, right? So of course, I get the results of this test and I think, I'm only 22 and I'm already doomed, or 21 at the time. I'm already doomed. All the things I'm good at, I have rejected and done all these other things. And so after this experience, I go back and I'm really depressed. It's January of my senior year and I am totally, totally depressed. And I turn on the radio and there is KPFA Pacifica. And there's a guy named Don Porche, who was the news director of KPFA in Berkeley. And he is reading George Orwell's Politics in the English Language. And he is reading this essay, which is an extraordinary political essay about the way we use language and politics and so forth. And at the end of this essay, he basically says, well, I'm the director of the news department at KPFA, and our philosophy of news is that we call things by their real names. And I went, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, for example, we don't say Red China, or we don't say, we say China. And we say the National Liberation Front, not the Viet Cong. This was, the middle of the Vietnam War. And I just listened. I was fascinated by this guy. And in the end, he asked for volunteers. And I called him up. I was with my heart in my throat because I was the kind of person who was very actually, you would never know this now, but I was fairly shy about actually putting myself out there. And I called him, and finally, with my heart in my throat, and he said, come on down. And he taught me how to sort of, look at wire copy and rewrite wire copy for the news and stuff like that. And I did that for 6 months, and I finally graduated and took a junk job coding surveys down for an NYU professor in New York and didn't have the guts. Actually, didn't even have the guts to walk into WBAI. I mean, it sounds crazy, but I didn't. And I finally walked in, And there was the program director. You've heard the story many, many times. The The program director was there.
And who was that?
And that was, why am I blanking? You know, it was the famous guy who went to Vietnam. It was, why am I blanking on his name?
Now I am, too.
Now I am, too. I'm completely blanking on his name. I'll remember it in a minute.
Okay.
But anyway, and the program director sort of plays footsies with me under the table. Now, remember, this is 68. This is 68, and we're still...
Like, I've heard, I'd forgotten.
Right. He plays footsies with me under the table, and he says to me that women don't do news because their voices are too high. And that, you know, but he might have a little assistance job for me. I mean, this really did happen.
Okay,
this
was... listeners, look at your radios and see me looking appalled.
Yes, right. This really did happen. But this was 68. And so even the great political lefty Pacifica was a sexist piece of garbage in many, many respects. And...
our garbage.
It was our garbage, right, exactly. So he told me finally that they didn't have anything, and too bad, and I went away, of course. And then I had brought my tape, my 7-minute tape of me reading the news, and I gave it, you know, to, why am I blanking on his name? He's so famous, too. He was like the most famous.
Dale Minor.
Yes, exactly. It was Dale Minor.
Dale Minor.
It was Dale Minor. So Dale Minor is like, takes my tape, plays footsie under the table, tells me that women don't do news because their voices are too high, and then loses my tape.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Gone. Gone from the world. So 3 weeks later, I sort of call back, and it turns out that the guy who did there was an 11:30 newscast, and that 11:30 newscast the guy who did it didn't want to do it anymore. He thought it was sort of a dead-end job, and so he left it. And so they had no one to do the 11:30 newscast. And so Dale Minor finally called me up and said, look, or I called him, and he said, look, if you're willing to do it for no money, typical Pacifica thing, you can do the 11:30 newscast. And so I had this regular job that ended at 5, and so at 5 I'd come into, I'd leave my job and come to WBAI, and I did this for the 11:30 newscast, which was just a 15-minute newscast before the war summary. And after about 4 or 5 months, they had a marathon, and they actually ended up hiring me for $85 a week, and that's how I ended up at WBAI.
Okay.
So anyway, so I did that. I became a newscaster. I went and covered the Black Panther trial. I went to Washington, everything. At a certain point, I decided I hated news. This is a really horrible thing to say as someone who makes their living as a journalist.
Yeah,
but I really, really was very sick of news in a way that I have to confess I am today. I still am today. There was something about it. I wanted something more eternal. I wanted something that people cared about in 50 years. And I knew in some deep way that no one would give a flying about who our congressman was in 50 years. I knew that, you know, the name of Senator so-and-so, the name of the finance chairman of this department, what no one would care about. I wanted things that were larger. And I remember reading Russell Baker's column in the New York Times in which he said, there will always be a coup. There will always be a hurricane. There will always be a tornado. What are the really long things? A new scientific discovery, an archaeological find, things that are really larger in a certain sense. So I really wanted the larger things. And I looked around BAI, and there were all these people, mostly men, with one exception, mostly men, who were doing live radio. And I didn't really feel that I didn't have, again, the chutzpah. You know, I didn't have a track record. I didn't have, I couldn't go up to the program director and say, give me a show. I didn't really feel I deserved such a thing. So I started thinking, well, what would I do? And at that time, no one was on the air from about 5-something to 7 in the morning.
Well, WBAI was not a 24-hour-a-day radio
station. What happened was this. Bob Fass would come on the air at midnight, and he would go off the air whenever he wanted to. And that could be...
And on the weekends, Steve
yeah,
closed.
Yeah. It could be 4:30 in the morning. It could be 5 in the morning.
It had to be after 3. Legally, he had, it had to be on until 3.
Right, exactly. But he often was... So from 5 to 7, and then 7 o'clock, Larry Josephson would come on during weeks. Larry the Bagel Man would come on and do his show.
On the dot.
On the dot. And so there was this window that no one was using. And given that I didn't have a lot of chutzpah to say, give me a show, I went up to them and I said, and I had this idea for a show. And I actually thought of the theme music before anything else. I'd heard that theme in Silent Running. And I thought, God,
well, you and I were together in a record store, in a 69-cent store. And we found that record. You found that record in a bin. And you said, I know this music. I have to use this. I was with you.
Wow, wow, because I love that theme, and I the movie was a mixed bag, but it was, although it's a fun movie, but
it's Bruce Stern being a psychotic, it's a
being
Bruce
a psychotic, and but there's this weird thing about plants and light and space that they get all
well,
wrong
I mean,
or whatever.
I mean, this I always point out is that here's this guy, he is Earth's last botanist, he is the expert, and it takes him 2/3 of the movie to, and the plant and the trees are dying, and he doesn't know why. He's the greatest botanist in the world, and he doesn't realize that trees need light.
Yeah, it's really bad. It's really bad.
It was written by Steve Bochco and Michael Cimino. I mean, you know, the man who wrote The Deer Hunter and Hill Street Blues. That's who wrote it. Directed by Doug Trumbull.
So anyway, so I sort of went to whoever was the program director at that time. I don't even remember who it was. It might have been, or the station manager. It might have been Goodman was still, Goodman might have still been the station manager at that point.
Goodman or Jerry Coffin?
I don't know. Anyway,
Goodman,
I went to,
probably.
Yeah, it was probably Goodman. So anyway, I went to whoever it was and I said, you're not using that time. Give it to me. I even said this. I said, fire me. Put me on unemployment. You know, I'll go on unemployment and give me these 2 hours from 5 to 7. I'll do a show. And if it works, you can hire me back. And that's how it happened.
And... so WBAI became a 24-hour-a-day radio station with that.
And I should say, the original idea of it was not, it wasn't all a science fiction show. It was just what, one day a week. It was everything. It was politics. It was feminism. It was ecology. We did this incredible reading. We did readings of whole novels, you know. Mm-hmm. We did all kinds of wild things.
I mean, 5 days a week. I mean, if I had the show 5 days a week, which I did for a while, that was never... The idea to do all science fiction is only when the show became only one day a week.
Exactly.
And even when I had it Thursdays and Fridays, because, Marnie mm-hmm. Mueller started giving away different, told me to start giving away different 5 to 7 slots for Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and I would keep Thursday and Friday.
Right.
And even then, Thursdays was the science fiction morning, and Fridays was just whatever I felt like.
No, we did all kinds of. At one point, we did the reading of the whole Ecotopia.
That's right.
Me and Paul Fisher, basically, Ernst Kallenbach's Ecotopia. We did the whole reading of it. It was wonderful, but it was really.
And
there
were amazing moments where I was engineering a lot of these shows. I was always there, and Margot would take. We were in the church. On 62nd Street and 1st Avenue, WBAI owned a deconsecrated church. And we take these cables, this is long before the days of wireless, and Marco would sit on the steps of the church. And cab drivers would drive up and say hi, and you talk to a couple of cab drivers. We even did a reading of The Big Flash by Norman Spinrad.
Oh, one of my favorite books. One of my favorite stories. Yes.
Yeah, it's a novella. It's a wonderful story.
It's an amazing, amazing novella. And it's in this book called Science Against Man.
Right.
Which is a fabulous set of short stories, of anthology of science fiction, sort of dystopian science fiction. Wonderful, wonderful book.
And it's a fine, great story by Spinrad. He's written a lot, but that's a good one. And of great moments. I have to tell people – that listening to Margot when she was doing Hour of the Wolf 5 days a week is one of the great, great moments in New York radio. It was mesmerizing.
Aww.
And it's true. It's true. But also, there was...
And I have to say, it's the best... You know, I've now been in radio, well, we're talking 68, 78, 88, 98, 100, 42 years.
Yep.
42 years. And Hour of the Wolf was the best thing that I think I ever did.
Yeah, it was a crowning
And the reason
point.
The reason it was, it had many, first of all, there's something about this time of day.
It's very special.
People open up. People are willing to talk about their deep selves in a way that they're not at 7 to 9 in the morning on a weekday, that they're not at, you know, 12 noon. People are willing to allow their dream self, we might say, their you know, that part of themselves they're not always willing to talk about during the day. And also there was this sense
it's
that...
It's the Varg team, and as the intro said, it's
and also world. And also there was this sense that because there weren't that many people listening, you could be a little more honest, perhaps. And I would get letters. I would get letters that rival anything I have ever received in the mail. Because
not to mention marriage proposals.
Well, I mean, well, you know, the funny thing was, the funny thing was, is that I can go on NPR, I can go on All Things Considered, let's say, and 2 million people will hear a piece, and it'll be a piece I've worked on for days, you know, and that I've put all my heart in, and the only response that I'll know about will be a card that says you pronounced Beijing wrong. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? And I mean, occasionally I'll get a really important letter or an email or something, but people would like write their hearts out. You know, I once went on the air and I said, how old was I at that point? 30, whatever. What? Let's see, 1972. Let's see, I'm 46, 56, 66. Yeah, I was in my 20s. Right? I was in my 20s.
I would have been 18.
You would have been 18?
Yeah.
How old are you now?
56.
Yeah, and I'm 64. So, oh, wait a minute. What are you? 56.
No, we're not 8 years apart. Are we?
I don't know. I'm 64.
You are? Okay.
Yeah.
So we are 8 years apart. Okay.
So I was in my 20s. And I went on the air. I remember this so well. And I said, you know, I'm 20-something, whatever, and I don't know if I ever want to have kids. I'm an only child, and I'm afraid I might break it, first of all. You know, I mean, I just don't know.
Alex isn't listening, is he?
What? No, he's definitely not listening. My 19-year-old is definitely not listening here. So I said, I'm just not really sure about this. And what's more, not only am I not sure, you know, I'm afraid that way down deep, if I was to have a kid, I would become a Stepford wife. I actually said this on the air. I've never forgotten this. I would become a Stepford wife because, you know, I'm really willing to be a rebel when I'm just by myself. But if I had a kid, I might really, you know, conform and succumb to the what my friend now – I didn't say this at the time, but what my friend calls the overculture. Anyway, so and I sort of just said this out on the air, and then people called up. People called up with babies wailing. People called up and said it was the best decision they'd ever made in their life. People called up and said it was not the best decision they ever made in their life. People then wrote me 10-page, single-spaced letters that I then read on the air in the next show. And then that would start things. So for a week, it was a continuity of community. It was a creation of community that I have never... You know, that I just don't remember seeing in almost any other place.
And the other live radio shows that were on BAI, some of them wonderful they were, didn't have that. And part of that was obviously you, but part of that is also this time slot.
Absolutely.
And this is why when people say, but Freud, you're not going off the air, I'm saying, no, but this is Hour of the Wolf. This is the end of that series. And it's a very, very special time.
It is.
And while things will continue here for the, you know, if the station survives and the crick don't rise, and this is something I don't know that the programmers who are trying to save the station understand, Hour of the Wolf is very, very special for that reason.
And I think the other thing is that it's true is that I think there's been a lack of memory about what live radio did in general.
Oh, yeah.
In that period.
That's right. That's
right. I think there was a real creation of community in a lot of these shows. And there were callers who created shows. There were callers out there who actually said, okay, let's go in this direction. And we did.
Yeah. I mean, the facility, maybe I should say the facility, because he's one of the great innovators.
Yeah, Fast was certainly...
He's still on, and he Fast still will be on.
And Post, Steve Post, and Larry Josephson,
Julius Lester, Paul Gorman.
And let's mention women, too.
Carol Ratner, Liza Cowan.
Liza Cowan, who really did the first, in a sense.
That's right.
And Mickey Waldman.
And Mickey Waldman.
Mickey Waldman.
Marion Waldman died about three years ago.
Yeah. And they were, you know, these were really amazing shows.
They really were. They really were. But there was still something about this slot.
Yes.
And that time. And
and when I heard this thing, which I'd never heard before, the thing you played at the very beginning,
the trailer for Hour
of the Wolf, and when they said babies were born, more babies are born at this hour.
Now that I
didn't even know that.
Okay, but I've always known, because Bergman wrote that in his autobiography. I think it's stated somewhere in the movie.
And I was born at 4:41, so I'm even in that.
And I was about 3:30.
Yeah, we're sort of in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Professor Veronica Sheamus was on the show last week as well. But when I had her on first, I guess about 2 years ago, and I've had her on pretty much every Halloween since. Although last week wasn't Halloween; it was the follow-up with her. And
Halloween takes a whole month.
Oh yeah, it really does. It really requires it. Samhain
is a whole month.
It really is. And when I was talking about the time of day, she teaches mythology and folklore and stuff like this at CUNY, at Queens College. Veronica just said, "Oh, Varkdemon." I said, "Excuse me? Varkdemon." I said, "Well, that's the Swedish name of the movie Hour of the Wolf. That's the real name of the movie." And she said, "Oh, that's all this ancient belief, and it's all about this." And then she, explained that whole thing.
I'm going to have to talk to this woman. I've never met her, and I'm going to have to interview her. I have?
You have met her at one of the New York Review of Science Fiction readings.
Well, I have to...
the two of you would... No, weren't properly introduced. It's one of those days when I was, doing show and tell. This is Margot, everybody, Right. So, that's my celebrity friend, so.
Get out of here. Anyway.
Anyway, you know what I would like you to do? You know what most people who are guests on the show, you're the host this morning. You're the co-host this morning.
I am the co-host, yes.
That's right. But most people, and something that you used to do, is they would you would read other people's work on the air. I would like you to read a small piece of your work on the air. Can you manage this screen? Can you read it at all?
Oh, is this the part?
Heretic's Heart.
The part that you put on the web. I was actually thinking, as you were talking, I was saying the one thing I would read is the one thing. Actually, let me get my glasses out that I bet it might recognize.
Yeah, and the problem. Maybe you should come over here because
This is okay.
Yeah, but you'll have to scroll.
Oh, I'll have to scroll, but that's okay. Yeah.
But you can just, indicate, and then I can scroll.
You can scroll after.
I can try to scroll for
where
you.
Where did I put these glasses?
Or I can put it on my droid, and you can look at it.
I know I have glasses in here somewhere. I put them somewhere in here. Let's see. I saw them this morning.
Let me remind people that
here
this
they are.
Is obviously WBAI in New York City. Listener
right.
sponsor.
99.5.
Non-commercial Pacifica.
Here we go. All right. So this is part of... this has part of the stuff I was actually talking about. This is a part of Heretic's Heart. Heretic's Heart came out in 1997. It is a memoir that goes from the 50s to about 1973, but a lot of it has to do with being a arrestee in the free speech movement in Berkeley, a civil rights worker in Mississippi in 1965, going to Cuba on the Venza Ramos Brigade, all kinds of other things like that. And And basically it's that, it's my memoir. And, but I put this one little piece on Jim's Hour of the Wolf website because it does talk about Hour of the Wolf. My religious and political confusion had permeated my working life. I'd become sick of journalism, of reporting what columnist Russell Baker dismissed as olds, cops, tornadoes, disasters, crimes, political upheavals, wars. Like Baker, I sought news, archaeological finds, scientific discoveries, things we might actually care about in 100 years or more. I desperately searched for the longer view, the more eternal. And I began to find it through radio in the early morning hours, the most magical time of day. It is 5 a.m. at the radio station. I'm sitting in almost total darkness, watching the dials in my solitary rocket ship. It's easiest to invoke the dream state in this darkness that mimics the starry night, where instead of the points of light from planets and stars, the lights are the buttons and dials of this radio studio, where I sit alone, the captain and engineer of this ship that makes a 2-hour journey every morning, starting at 5 a.m. My rocket is named Hour of the Wolf, and just like the Enterprise, its mission is to explore new worlds. And in sadder, more reflective moments, I think that despite the moon landing and the hopes it raised, this is the closest I will get to the other planets in my lifetime. I have to digress and say that this is so much more true now than when I wrote it. The early hours of the morning when most people are asleep and few are listening, and those that are awake may still be half in dream and reverie, allow conversations that would never even begin later in the day. During these hours, people are willing to reveal their deepest hopes and fears in a state of innocence. The radio can allow imagination and fantasy to soar, perhaps by encouraging the same intimacy, imagined or real, that Mark and I created in those letters that crossed from Berkeley to Vietnam and back. Digression, I was in love with a Vietnam soldier. I was a Berkeley demonstrator. There's a lot of that in the book. The thing about radio, as Tony Schwartz, the public relations genius, once said, is that people were born without earlids. Unlike television pictures, sound flows all around us, and the flood of images that come to us from those sounds is in large part our own creation. Today we live in a world of strident talk shows, where received opinions on the state of the world are trumpeted back and forth, and anyone who might dare to unfurl a hope is quickly put down. But at WBAI-FM in the early 70s, a period of wild and wonderful experimentation in freeform radio was taking place. Pioneers like Bob Fass, Steve Post, Larry Josephson, Liza Cowan, and others could open the phone lines and just let people talk, never screening a single call. I've been given this 2-hour show because no one else is using it. I don't yet have the chutzpah to ask for anything better. But here I am, free to try my hand while I live on an unemployment check of $32 a week. If the show's a success, WBAI will hire me back. At 5 in the morning, there's nothing that can't be changed. Mostly there are questions and feelings and yearnings. Anything can happen. A story is read on the air, an interview is conducted, the phone lines are opened, and anyone can turn the world upside down, or at least change the ship's course. A cab driver begins a show by calling in to talk about the day that passed. A science fiction story prompts a discussion on utopian and dystopian ideas. A woman reads a document called the Asexual Manifesto on the air, and calls from the solitary and celibate follow for days. I tell about my experiences with group sex, and another week of intimate conversation begins. Or I close my eyes and speak into the ether about my ambivalence about having children, my fear that I will be trapped in a system that I have always avoided, that my need to be accepted will triumph over my need for freedom, that I will be transformed into a Stepford wife, having been an only child, I haven't learned how to take care of a child. The letters pour in. I read them on the air and talk continues. Women call up with babies wailing in the background. Some talk of the unexpected wonder of their children, the joy of participating in life and community, while others dare to ponder if they have made a huge mistake. Over the course of 3 weeks, a friend and I read Ecotopia, Ernst Kallenbach's underground classic, over the air. How many people are listening? Certainly thousands. Certainly not hundreds of thousands. But the depth and intimacy of response is larger than one can calculate. I still have boxes of letters, multi-page, single-space outpourings. Now in the 1990s, when I wrote this, several million people may listen to one of my reports on All Things Considered, and I might not receive a single response. But in the 1970s, on that 5 a.m. show, it was possible to create a community of seekers. I play with the occult. I invite palmists and astrologers to enter my spaceship. I remain a skeptic, although an astrologer tells me I will write a book before I'm 40, and I do. And a palmist tells me my parents were separated around age 11, which they did. Psychics and healers enter my dark and starry studio. So do psychologists and anthropologists. Those on the edge of science come into my rocket ship. The creators of holograms, people who talk to plants, those who say they can photograph auras. I watch the psychic Uri Geller read my mind as he sits behind me. Is he a fraud? Or does he augment his genuine talent by cheating? I'm suspicious of all systems, refuse all gurus, but believe that, at bottom, we are so much more than we think. I believe that Australian Aborigines can smell water, so why shouldn't a psychic occasionally be able to read my mind? I do believe that all religious and magical systems contain a kernel of some ancient knowledge, usually encoded in an unacceptably authoritarian system. The old Marxist inside me warns that all this religious stuff is an opiate, an oppressor. Sometimes it is. But I also know that religion means to relink, and that meditation and ritual allow me to enter a timelessness and to encounter the real mysteries of birth, life, death, and regeneration. A teacher of mind dynamics tells me that the little child who got napalmed in Vietnam didn't have to be there if she didn't want to. Boy, I rage, these occult philosophies do let the anxious middle class feel secure with their privilege. I'm desperate to understand the divide. Where is spirituality liberating? Where is it oppressive? Science fiction provides a structure for my wanderings. The writers troop into my cabin. Peter Beagle, Ursula Le Guin, Joanna Russ, Norman Spinrad, Samuel Delaney, Robert Anton Wilson, and countless others. In the late 20th century, theirs is the only literature of ideas we have. Dismissed as genre fiction while the literati spend hours reading books that do nothing more than chronicle failing relationships, science fiction explores everything from telepathy to politics. Nothing is taken for granted. Society, love, and work, even gender, are remade. There are anarchist and capitalist utopias and worlds in which human beings travel faster than the speed of light, sport wings, and experiment with their own genetic engineering. There is always further, as the old 60s slogan said. Feminism, from politics to sexuality, is also part of my world. And ecology and green politics and critiques of technology that say, hold on, you can't remake everything without destroying the earth. Theodore Roszak and Murray Bookchin make their appearance. Amidst this explosion of variety in the early morning hours, is there any order? Very few things seem evil, except apathy. That which aids potential is good. That which limits is evil. Creative order is good, as is creative disorder, as Robert Anton Wilson once said. Destructive order and destructive disorder are bad.
Wow.
It still is exactly what I think. That's what's funny. I mean,
yeah,
I wrote this 13 years ago, you know, and it still is exactly what I think.
Yeah. But it is so descriptive of what the possibilities are with live radio, with the thinking, and it brings back the show that you did. which was an exceedingly special time. It was so personal. It was so personal that Margot and I would go, you and I would go out to, you know, the local coffee shop.
That's right.
Where, you know, sitting there with iced coffee and whatever, being served by a woman who Margot eventually married me to, a marriage which lasts months. Right. And
one of my few failures. As a minister, one of my few failures.
And, well, it's called a hand fasting. But anyway, right. And one time she says, okay, Freund, I'm going to tell you something. And I swear, if you ever tell anybody this, I will never, ever speak to you again. This is so private. This is so personal. And then you told me about fantasies you were having about Tom Seaver.
Oh, my God. I completely forgotten this, but I did. It was Tom Seaver and the spaceman.
Yes, that's right. And Billy.
Were my two baseball player fantasy people.
Yeah, I'll pull the mic a little closer to you. Right. So you're telling me, so Freund, so this is what's been going on. And I get these, well, intimate details of these dreams and these fantasies and all that. And I'm sworn to absolute utter secrecy. 3 hours later, Margot is on the air on Hour of the Wolf. The lights are all out. I'm engineering, like now, and she's telling exactly all this stuff that I was sworn to absolute secrecy on, telling it right on the air to the most intimate of creations, the Hour of the Wolf audience.
Yeah,
that was the relationship that you had with the listeners.
No, that you know
it was that tight, that close, and people listening at home. There was not listening at home in the dark, in their bedrooms or whatever. I mean, obviously, there's cab drivers out there, and we're even now at 5:52, approaching prime time. There's still this amazing intimacy,
right,
that can be done with this time slot. I mean, it's an amazing thing. It's conceivable that I could end up with, you know, what people would consider a much better time slot than 5 to 7 a.m., but you know, better in terms of popularity, better in terms of
exactly.
Numbers, better in terms of quantity and even, you know, fame, such mm-hmm. as it is on WBAI, but not better in terms of the intimacy of what one can do here and now in this slot, which is why this celebration we're having this morning of this last episode of Hour of the Wolf in the Hour of the Wolf. It will be somewhere. I will land somewhere. The show will be good. Margot will be on NPR, and hopefully Margot will be back on WBAI, especially if I get a more, well, shall we say, accessible time slot. But this is a very special time. R. Paul Sidney, you're going to be moving in here. Take care of it. I know you will. You're both great. You know, but you know, 5 to 7. Now, what happened was, because I'll carry the story, Margot went to the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop, which is this amazing, amazing thing. And I was accepted also that same year, but I could not go. I couldn't afford the money to travel. I couldn't.
It was in Washington State. So it was at the University of Washington.
Yeah, it was one of the first Clarion Wests. And I don't think they
And it was amazing. We should just say that there was 1 week with Ursula Le Guin. There was 1 week with Joanna Russ. There was 1 week with Peter Beagle. There was 1 week with,
Well, Damon Knight and Kate Wilhelm, right?
Yeah, but then there was.
They were always there.
Yeah, they were always there. I missed that week. But then there was, my wonderful friend, the short.
Harlan.
There was Harlan
What's
Ellison.
His name?
What's his name? Harlan Ellison. Harlan Ellison. But the week with Ursula was one of the most amazing. And actually, the week with Peter Beagle was one of the most amazing weeks I've ever
had. I mean,
they
all would have been.
They were all incredible. I mean, they
Peter's
were all coming, incredible.
Peter will be here, like, you know, in...
Yeah.
Oh, and next week.
Really?
Not in New York. He'll be in, he's the guest of honor at PhilCon.
Oh, really?
In Philadelphia.
And you know,
and the day after PhilCon. Oh, wow.
And he came on and sang.
That's right.
Do you remember, you know, he is actually not only a great writer, but he sings in this kind of French Georges Brassens kind of way. And he has this incredible cycle of songs that he's done that I don't think they've ever been recorded except by us and by people, but they've never come out on a CD, and it's really a shame.
I think he's got a couple of recordings.
Does he
of
now
them.
Have
yeah,
them now?
Yeah,
oh,
he
I
does.
Really have to. I have to
he
look
does.
And see because
but
they were amazing.
But he's very much around there. There's a he's
I
been
get
doing
a newsletter.
Theater.
I get a yeah, newsletter from
the
him.
Raven.
Raven yeah. The Raven, yes.
Yeah, which is put out by Freff Connor. Mm-hmm. But I always knew him as Freff is now Peter's representative and. I interviewed Peter about...
So anyway, you were saying that I went away for...
So you went away to Clarion to this amazing experience, and when...
And found out that I would probably never be a fiction writer.
Maybe, although...
Well, you never know.
I think
you
there's
know.
An alternate history in which you're one
be.
Of the biggies, you know,
we're
one of the greats in fantasy literature, maybe even writing vampire novels. We'll talk
well,
about
a
vampires
a
in a while.
A non-fiction novel.
Or a non-fiction. Yeah, book, but at any rate, I'm saying the alternate universe.
Oh, right. The alternate universe. Oh, right.
The alternate universe where after Clarion.
But fiction was hard. Fiction was hard.
Oh, it's hard work.
It's very hard, and it takes, if you've spent 42 years being wedded to truth with a capital T, which is what journalists do, hopefully, it's hard to become a fiction writer.
It's very hard. It's very hard. It's very difficult to make a living at it. Most science fiction writers certainly are what they call mid-list. Mm-hmm. And they can't make a living at it. They have to do other things. And God forbid you're a short story writer. You can earn, $30 for that short story that you spent 2 months on.
I think I wrote 5 short stories, one for each of those weeks.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I would say only one of them was in any way any good.
But you also inspired other people to write short stories, like Gary Fried, who vicariously went through your Clarion experience. He wrote that story about the tornado, remember? That was a really interesting story. I was, from the start, pretty much your co-host Thursdays and Fridays. And you had other occasional co-hosts, usually Mondays, Neil Conan... wasn't Mike Hodel on a few times?
I don't remember.
I think he was. And then he became news director at KPFK.
Right.
And he started a science fiction show there called Hour 25, which is still on by successors of his in a web format. Mm-hmm. And when I continued to doing the show, and in 1980-something, early 80s, Simon Lokely was doing 5 to 8:30 a.m. That was what had been Gary Fried's time slot for the morning after the night before. And then Simon Lokely, you know, did the show for 2 or 3 years, at which point his best friend became program director and immediately cut Simon's show in half by putting me in there. And I went kicking and screaming. I was on Thursday mornings at that point. And, you know, at least weekdays I thought were, you know, prime time, drive time and all that. And Steve Erickson said, no, you'll, you know, go on Saturday mornings and it'll be good. And it has been, I must say. You know, I've been in this slot for almost, you know, Saturdays for almost 20 years. It's still 5 to 7, though. It's still that special thing.
Mm-hmm.
And having only one show a week, I decided that what Margot called the science fiction spectacular was the phrase that we used, that I eventually co-hosted. Margot didn't know if I would be any good. You know, I'm this kid. And one more, and she would be reading these stories on the air. But I helped supply her with one or two guests, like George Alec Effinger,
right?
You know who was
Piglet.
You
right?
were Piglet, who you were surprised how good he was.
He was great.
He was wonderful. He was wonderful. He was a great guy.
He was terrific.
I miss him, and And he gave up the Piglet after a few years. After he moved to New Orleans, he came back, and I said, "Piglet." He said, "George, it's George." But anyway, and I was at a Lunacon, and by the next Lunacon, he's died. Mm. He was very young, very sad. Mike O'Dell died very young, and I miss him as well. But and he was in the news department here, then went to KPFK. But anyway, so. You know, during these years, I have kept alive this science fiction, speculative fiction show. And by the way, not, you know, I thought of myself as following in the footsteps not only of Margot, but Baird Searles.
Now, we should say this is WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. It is 6 o'clock.
Oh, my God. An hour left. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So the 5 o'clock hour, which is, you know, the weird magical hour, is gone. And let me just say, I mean, some of the people that I have been, you know, so privileged to have on the air. I mean, if I was to do, you know, the roll of credits of the people I have to thank and all that, it would take forever. But, you know, there's a list on my website at ourwolf.com of the guests who I've had on the air. I have a flyer that in like 6-point type, I can't get many of the names on there. But in the 70s still, thanks to Larry Josephson, there was this fellow going around holding BBC transcription discs of radio drama he had done in England. And he left a copy of those discs accidentally on purpose here. And we played them illegally on Hour of the Wolf. And I can say because he's unfortunately dead. But that's how Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy made its premiere in this country. I know on Mike O'Dell's Wikipedia entry they say he did it. But that's not true. Mike did it a whole week later. Because Douglas Adams came from here to KPFA. And accidentally, on purpose, left a series of the discs there. So we did it on Hour of the Wolf like a week earlier. Then Mike did it in L.A. The NPR did it like 3 years later. And by that time, Douglas was writing the books. And so many people, when you say Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, people say, "Oh, I love that book." It was a radio drama. It was a radio drama heard first on this continent in this time slot. On this show, Larry Josephson was the one who Douglas Adams had gotten in touch with, and he said, "Oh, science fiction, give it a find." And so, you know, that's one of many hallmarks that this show has had. And, you know, the thrill I've had Le Guin on this show. I mean, I'm just looking, you know, through some of the names. If I say some, I can't. I'm doing injustice to others. My very first live radio show was with Isaac Asimov and Fred Pohl and Lester Del Rey. That was my very first show. And Isaac's very last show was with me, was an episode of Hour of the Wolf before he passed. I believe I did the last interview with Octavia Butler before she died. And she was on this show about four times, four or five times. And she was neat. Actually, the last show she did, the show before the last, she actually recorded in my house in Brooklyn. And, there are other stories. But, I mean, there are just so many amazing, wonderful people. 11 years ago, Ray Bradbury, when he was in New York for the National Book Award for receiving the award for Fahrenheit 451,
I remember John Brunner coming here.
Oh, God. Brunner was amazing. Brunner was absolutely amazing. And Barry Molesberg, who may be listening right now, he generally listens to WBAI, and he's been corresponding with me a great deal about the end of Hour of the Wolf, and he offered to be here this morning and all that. I actually had him on in September for our usual annual thing, and it was a great show. And Molesberg said that one of the greatest moments that he heard on radio was, Alfred Bester sitting in our control room reading the story, The Men Who Murdered Mohammed. But Margot recorded John Brunner reading poetry entitled At the Foot of the Apocalypse. which was originally for Hour of the Wolf. And Brunner's, and he was an amazing reader and all that. I interviewed him for his guest of honor speech at Lunacon, you know, getting up in front of everybody. And he said, oh, let's be absolutely free and off the cuff. Then he handed me a list of questions. But he was quite a character. You know, having Alfred Bester, you know, one of the great radio writers, comic book writers, novelists of all time. Joanna Russ, when she lived in New York, would come up for Margot regularly. And Margot produced The Image of Women in Science Fiction.
That's right. And the story, you know, Joanna Russ is a very strange story, if you think about it, because she's such a great writer. And all of her books have been a lot of her books have been republished just recently.
And, yeah, by Wesleyan University right. Press, same people who do Delaney.
And they contacted me recently. Did I tell you this story?
No,
it's a sort of a
they're great people there.
Well, they contacted me and they said, would you like to do a profile retrospective on Joanna Russ? And I said, absolutely. Absolutely. Totally absolutely. I said, you know, I studied with her at Clarion. She has been on, you know, she was on my show, Hour of the Wolf. Absolutely. You know, they sent me the books. And then they said, you know, we could give you so-and-so to talk about her and talk about her. And I said, yeah, but, you know, you have to let me talk to Joanna because I haven't, you know. And she's in a very reclusive spot, and they did not.
Physically and psychically, yeah.
But she was not willing to talk to me. And I said, I'm sorry, I cannot do this piece unless I have her.
Yeah.
And so I didn't do it.
Yeah.
So I don't know the whole story, but.
I can tell you a little something about it, but a lot of it has to do with a lot of physical pain.
Mm.
And a lot of difficult issues in her life
mm-hmm.
that, are just have separated her from socializing with a lot of the world at large.
Got it. I mean, she always...
And it's been for years now.
And even at Clarion, she was much more reclusive. You know, she was a very reclusive soul, you know, even then.
I guess, although, I don't know. I sat with her in that same coffee shop.
Oh, yeah, when she was on the show, she was great. She was totally great.
Absolutely wonderful. Yeah.
Great, really.
Absolutely
and
wonderful.
Writing is
another person
fabulous.
Who I miss.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, I wish she'd write more.
Mm-hmm.
I really wish she would write more. And not just didactic stuff, although she's a great academic. But, I miss her fiction. She's one of the greats.
Mm-hmm.
So, I can't name all the people. I can reminisce. I can remember some of the amazing moments. I only recorded Ted Sturgeon. I never actually had him live at 5 a.m., but... And same was true for Kurt Vonnegut. But I dare say, and this will continue, that, you know, we will continue to bring some of the best science fiction and fantasy and speculative fiction, and not writers, because I don't define this stuff very well. I try not to. I purposely try, you know, it's like, it is what it is. And... I've just got to say it to so many people, which includes all of the listeners. Thank you. And to Margot especially, because this is a very, very, very special place, this 5 to 7 a.m. thing. And I know that the programming person and people here think that, well, they're escalating me, that they're doing me a favor. I know they consider what they're doing for me an upgrade. But, you know, it can never be this. It can never be this.
Well,
you know, so on that
note, do we want to go somewhere else? Do we want to take calls?
We want to play a piece of music.
Okay.
And when we come back, I'll do a couple of announcements and maybe calls.
And calls, and then we'll go into
vampirism.
Vampirism.
Yes, indeed.
Vampirism.
So, you know, with that teary note that I just had, here's a teary song.
Sit by my side, come as close as the air, share in a memory of gray, and wander in my words, dream about the pictures that I play of changes. Green leaves of summer turn red in the fall, to brown and to yellow they fade, and then they have to die, trapped within the circle time parade of changes. Scenes of my young years were warm in my mind, visions of shadows that shine, till one day I returned and found they were the victims of the vines of changes. The world spinning madly, it drifts in the dark, swings through a hollow of haze, a race around the stars, a journey through the universe ablaze with changes. Magic will glow in the night. All fears of the forest are gone. But when the morning breaks, they're swept away by golden drops of dawn of changes. Passions will part to a strange melody, as fires will sometimes burn cold, like petals in the wind. We're puppets to the silver strings of souls of changes. Your tears will be trembling now, we're somewhere else. One last cup of wine we will pour, and I'll kiss you one more time, and leave you on the rolling river shores of changes. So sit by my side, come as close as the air, share in a memory of gray, wander in my words, dream about the pictures that I play of changes.
Phil Oakes. Ugh, I mean, okay, I was teary, and that didn't cure it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, nothing like playing a teary song to basically re-tear.
re-intro the show.
This is Hour of the Wolf, the one and only Hour of the Wolf on WBAI-FM at 99.5. And we are here for what is apparently the last Hour of the Wolf in this time slot.
In the Hour of the Wolf slot.
That does not mean that Hour of the Wolf is going away totally. It will probably be at another time slot, but we don't yet know what it is. And I'm Margo Adler, who once upon a time actually created Hour of the Wolf many, many 38 years ago, and then left it in the incredibly good care of one James Freund.
Yeah, who has always aspired to be as good as what Adler did. But no, I mean...
But you've that become that. You've become better.
I've become a different thing.
And also, you've become professional. You know, I mean, we were all...
Oh, God,
I mean, we were all unprofessional in those days. I mean, we all did. I mean, no, if I listen to some of my air checks, I cringe. But anyway, that's
but
a whole
other story. But some of those air checks of yours...
Some of them were great. Some of them were great.
Oh, and by the way, some very dear people who have been a major part of this show over the last few years have offered to help me create a podcast of some of those classic tapes. So we have to take some of yours.
That would be lovely.
And put those freely available on the web.
Right.
And so... you know, more on that as time goes on. Let me tell people, though, a couple of announcements. Number one, Simon Lokely, this Monday at the Swift, 34 East 4th Street, will be performing The Sermon from Moby Dick. Simon's Stand-Up Academy, if you have never seen it, is just this wonderful space. I mean, Simon talked about it for years. I never went. And Barbara and I went to one of his readings, one of his James Joyce things, about 6 months ago. And we're regulars now. We're addicted. Cannot miss it. So that's this Monday. Admission is free at the Swift, 34 East 4th Street, for the Sermon from Moby Dick, one of Simon's great, and I can't be there because, and you should not go either, Margo, because I should try to get you to where I'm going, to the annual Science Fiction Writers of America Writers and Editors Party at Planet Hollywood this Monday. That's not open to everybody, but I can extend an invite to you.
I might go.
Ooh, that yeah.
We'll talk.
I mean, that's everybody.
I have to think.
Peter Beagle will
look
be
at,
there.
Oh, really?
Peter Beagle will be there, I promise you. Everybody will be there. You know, Spinrad. I mean, I hope Norman's well enough. Norman's been sick of late. He was at Sloan Kettering for a while, but he got out. And I believe he's doing well, but... so anyhow, this Monday, opposite the Science Fiction Writers of America soiree, Simon Lokely at the Swift, 34 East 4th Street. For more information, dial 212-360-3600. It is too early to be promoting the next New York Review of Science Fiction reading, but this is the last time I'm going to be on in this time slot, so I'm going to do it anyway. And most importantly, it's not the first Tuesday this coming month. It's usually the first Tuesday. But because there's going to be a memorial for this well-known agent of a lot of science fiction writers on December 7th, which is the first Tuesday, we're postponing it for a week. So it'll be December 14th will be the next New York Review of Science Fiction reading at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, 138 Sullivan Street. Our readers will be Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman, my favorite family for Christmas. And Claire Wolf Smith will be the guest curator. And for more, and then in January, I mean, that's far away, but the lineup is so great. Ron Hogan will be the guest curator. I mean, celebrity guest curator. And who's he bringing in? Rick Moody and Gary Steingart. So, like, if you're not a huge bestseller, you know, you're not reading that much. I mean, these are big. You're even reading one of those
books. I'm reading the Super Sad True Whatever Love Story, which is amazing.
Yeah. He's an amazing guy. Apparently, like, the minute after Ron was off the phone with Gary Steingart, he created a Facebook page. It's like, no, I'll do that. It's okay. If people want to know more, go to ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF. The list of people who've been on the show, the excerpt that Margot just read, the information on the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, all of that is available at ourwolf.com. And you can follow my Twitter feed. I am Jim Freund, J-I-M-F-R-E-U-N-D. And find out where I'll be. I mean, I am slated to be on the air next week in my new time slot of 7 to 8 a.m. But I think it's not just between you and me. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. More changes will be made, and they may be very well changes for the good. The program director understands very well that I feel very constrained in 1 hour. It's very difficult to have a writer on. Not yet. Margot said, I'm blanking on her name.
Terry Gross.
Terry Gross does a brilliant show. But all she does is she does an interview with a writer in 1 hour. I do a complete short story and an interview, plus phone calls. That's very, and if I can, music. So it really takes a minimum of 90 minutes. And I do believe that the programming department, such as it is, the powers that be, at any rate, understand this. And I think there are other changes afoot involving the suspension of Mr. Locally. I don't think that suspension will be forever. And there are limited times that Simon can do a show. So somehow I don't know that the time slot that Hour of the Wolf is being moved to will last. In fact, I don't think it's going to begin. But this is not despondency. These aren't changes afoot. Not. And this is a ceremony. This is a celebration. In the Shakespearean sense of the word, of our, you know, funeral is a celebration in Shakespeare. You know, but
so we can call it a wake.
yeah. At 6:20 in the morning,
it's a wake. Although we don't have the appropriate imbibing fluids.
There is that. However, I was doing. I had some Jameson's last night.
So, that's right.
If you would like to call up and speak with Margot Adler and Jim. The telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. And by the way, it would appear that we're going to be here till 8:30 in the morning. So we have a little time left. But the Hour of the Wolf portion of it is only another half hour or so. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning, Robert.
Marco Adler.
Hi.
Hello, Marco.
Bob Rodriguez.
Hi, Robert.
The chairman of the board. You know, I taught history for 40 years, but this is real history. To me, the best oral history I had ever read was Studs Terkel's Oral History of World War II. But step back to Studs. This is oral history at its very best.
A-U-R-A-L.
Yes. And A. But, it's funny. I wondered who was that other voice on the first chorus of All Around My Hat. And I said, Is Margo singing
that was,
along
that,
with...
That was nasty of me, wasn't it?
No, I thought it was great. You were on pitch, Margo. You really were.
Margo's a great contralto. And I produced a production of Rudigore here.
Oh, really?
Margo was a featured singer in the chorus.
Really? Are you a contralto? What is a contralto, Marco?
I don't know what a contralto is.
An alto or a tenor?
I'm somewhere between. I'm basically, you know, I'm someone who, I'm like a not high soprano. So
that's right. Yeah, a contralto is a low soprano.
A low soprano, okay. Yeah.
Well, you were on pitch with Matty Pryor.
Well, you know, I was a voice student at Music and Art.
You were?
Yes, I was. Okay. And I was in choruses and madrigal groups. even in college. But
Margo sang her school theme song
but now,
for Judy Sherman on the air.
But on the other hand, and now I still do, the only singing, I do chant workshops. I do...
You do what?
Chant workshops.
You mean like Buddhist chant?
Not Buddhist, more pagan.
Pagan, oh, of course.
Pagan chants, oh. Yeah. You know, like, there's some beautiful, there. I even give out a chant sheet of 50 chants.
You know, I was thinking about you about 2 weeks ago, because there is a women's, unfortunately, they're disbanded, but there's a, I just came across a quartet, two CDs by a quartet from England called the Witches of Elswick.
Oh, my heavens.
They are a four-part harmony group, all a cappella, and they do traditional, and they do pagan.
Hmm.
But unfortunately, they disbanded 3 years ago, but they do have two wonderful CDs. Memories of Hours of the Wolf, Hour of the Wolf. Jim's interview with Susanna Clarke.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, was a great interview.
Margot has not yet read Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Oh, my.
Norrell, but
have you got a treat?
I know. That's it's what a, Jim was just telling me that
it
before.
Is a big book.
That's what I heard, 1,000 pages.
You know, books over 600 pages to me, they better be worth it.
This one is. It
really
justifies
is.
Its length.
Well, I'm really glad of that, because the last 760-page book I read this summer, I didn't think was worth it.
Well, no, I mean, there are certain books that are worth it. No, there's certain
I read
books
The Passage, and I had my issues.
No, there's certain books, you know, Myths of Avalon, Michener's Centennial,
right.
Shogun, you know, some of the books, I mean, some of the big
Lord
books,
of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Right.
You know, the other memory I have, of course, is Harlan Ellison reading Searching for Kadok.
Yeah, well, that was actually done by Mike Hodel.
It was?
Yes.
Not you?
Not me, no.
But he gave you...
I was in the room. I was in the room.
I do remember that show.
It was absolutely, you know, fantastic. By the way, James, I'm doing a project for you. I've decided that with all the references to Hour of the Wolf and the Swedish movie and all that stuff, I'm doing an oral search for all oral references in literature, and when it's done, I'm going to present it to you.
Oh,
as,
thank you.
As a package.
Okay, and especially about the Varg Teeman and
yes.
All that, not the punk rock. Band.
No. I'm doing. I think I told you recently. I found a 17th century Neapolitan reference to it in
right.
Lace Pentameron, and I found six other versions. I'm also doing another thing. I'm looking at all the languages where the word dawn and twilight do not exist as a word,
ooh.
But as a concept.
Right.
And, you know, hour between the dog and the wolf, you know, that sort of thing.
And in Sweden, the dawn is very, the twilight, that's for hours.
I'm sorry?
In Sweden, at the right time of year, the you know, the twilight.
Twilight is forever, yeah.
Oh. Well, you know, there are places.
another Bergman film about the twilight is Smiles of a Summer Night.
I've never heard of that film.
You haven't?
No.
I haven't either.
A lot of movies, James, I haven't heard of.
Okay, well, Smiles of Summer Night is, again, one of Bergman's great films. It's
really?
Made into a musical called Little Night Music by Stephen Sondheim. It's on Broadway now.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Robert, for calling.
Yeah, well, you know, listen, you were the... You were the doyen. You were the
That's a good word.
Yes. No. You know, you and James were sort of the... I'm going to make a literary analogy. If in Lord of the Rings, Sauron had a boss. He was in First Age of Middle Earth.
Right.
Where he was but the servant of Thangorodrim.
As explained in the Silmarillion. Yeah.
That's right. But anyway, Margo, are you still with NPR? You're still
yes,
doing
I am.
Wonderful
I'm still
yes, I
Margo's the
still.
Bureau chief.
Well, I'm not. There's no
not
real
the
bureau.
Chief.
There's never been a bureau chief, is the truth.
What's your actual?
I'm a correspondent. That's
yeah,
what
but you're
I
more
am.
Than that.
Well, I'm a correspondent.
Okay, fine.
Well, you have that. You have that wonderful voice that comes across, that makes people want to listen. That's all I can say. Someone who loves to hear voices and people read and good stuff like that. By the way.
And we have to then move on because
right.
we have...
Yeah, just one quick thing. We're still involved, Margo, with Rebels this year.
Uh-huh.
And
oh,
we're
yes.
doing German-Bavarian.
Oh, my heavens.
And I have to thank you for that invitation. I'm likely to take you up on it.
You will?
I'm likely to. I have to check
well,
the dates.
Well, I have to talk to you then because if you want the good tickets, you're going to have to tell me in the next week or two. Can I call you at home?
This week is difficult. I'll write you.
No, next... What?
This week is difficult.
Well, all right. Cause
there's many changes in my life.
Oh, okay. Well, I
as you can hear from
good.
On the air. Well, we'll find out.
By the way, Margo, it's going to be at the Barrio Museo on 105th Street and 5th Avenue this year, not Symphony Space.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That's anyway, a great space, actually.
Yes, it is. Hexer Theater. All right, we'll talk.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Hey, good morning. And hi there, you're on the radio. Hi there.
Yes, hey, good morning.
Good
morning. I'm enjoying your show. Jim, I tried to get in back in last week. I had a couple things maybe I can share this morning, but I wanted to thank you for letting us know exactly who Margo Adler was, because we didn't know that was the Margo Adler, you know.
You know, that happens all the time. I had, last week, I had Veronica Shanis and Helen Polonofsky, two professors, on the show, and I was mentioning Margo a few times, and Helen was going, yeah, right, okay, and you know, yeah, she knew Margo from vaguely from NPR and all that. And at one point, I mentioned Drawing Down the Moon, and Helen said, "That Margo Adler, the Margo Adler." She was so excited.
Well, the truth is that one of the reasons that a lot of people believe that there are two Margo Adlers is because I'm sort of, you know, at NPR, I'm sort of not supposed to sort of reveal too much about my other life, because reporters are supposed to be these sort of, you know, sort of semi-neutral people, even though,
you don't talk about
not.
The UN and then so, say, blessed be.
Exactly. You got it. So the truth is, and, you know, so that my whole religious and spiritual life and all that, even though it's in my, if you go to the bio on NPR, my NPR bio, it does mention Drawing Down the Moon and Heretic's Heart and all that kind of stuff. But because I don't cover religion, because they sort of believe that since I'm sort of a spokesperson for an alternative religion, I shouldn't cover religion because it's kind of a conflict of interest in their mind. But because of that, there's this, you know, there's this perception that there are two completely different Margo Adlers. And so this happens to me all the time. They say, "Oh, you're the Margo Adler." And I thought the Margo Adler on NPR and the Margo Adler who's, you know, a Wiccan priestess pagan person are totally different people. And I said, "Nope, they're not."
They're one and the same.
You got it.
And there's the other Margo Adler, who's also the, you know, granddaughter of Alfred Adler.
Oh, that's all. They're all the same person.
Let me throw out my couple questions, a couple points of clarification. I'll listen over the air for that, and I have a comment and a mini book review that I tried to share because, Jim, I had tuned in late, so I hadn't heard your substantive conversation with Professor Shamus. Is it Jennifer, her first name?
Veronica.
And when you got back to that, I wanted to share a book, which I'm going to do in a sec. But when you guys mentioned an author and Professor Joanna, it became she, so I had been distracted or had stepped away. So
Joanna Russ.
Russ,
R-U-S-S.
Okay, great. And the Robert mentioned a book, but I didn't get the book name that he was recommending.
Oh, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clark.
Jonathan Strange and Mr.
Norrell, N-O-R-R-E-L. Americans would say Norrell, but Susanna says Norrell.
Okay, and the author again?
Susanna Clark, C-L-A-R-K-E.
Okay, good. Now, one of my questions is, Jim, you mentioned you tried to give us some idea about the new grid around your two shows,
mm-hmm.
you and so I'm a little unclear. I'd like Margo to clarify when she'll be on the air and whether she'll be because
I won't be on the air. I mean, I'm not on the air on NPR. I mean, on BAI.
Margo left WBAI when? About
90.
About 1990.
I thought I had heard you say that she would be returning.
When I find out what my new time slot is, if it's a time slot that's accessible to her, I will be having her on
occasionally, as much as
she can.
Yeah, no. I'm still not back at BAI because I'm...
Well, let me make a comment. I'm very disappointed to hear that. I don't know how I got that wrong, but what's going on is somewhat of a head scratcher or an eyebrow raiser, in a manner of speaking. Jim, at the beginning of the program, you said to effect that you believed it was good intentions, or something similar. Well, my mom used to always tell us, good intentions, you know where they lead, straight to hell. And what one of my main concerns is that when you're grounded in the Pacifica Charter / mission, when you're ethically based, when you have some PR, public affairs consciousness and savvy, you what you do is you announce that you're thanking your listeners, you're looking to serve them better, and you actively engage them because you have people who send in their, you know, their last
money. The listeners are the sponsors, is what
exactly.
I think you're trying to say.
So how that there's this disconnect where, you know, and I've actually tried to, you know, leave messages and, give a heads up because you're supposed to say, for example, have 3 2-hour sessions where you're taking in the listeners' ideas, suggestions, and input, and just the opposite seems to happen. But let me share this wonderful book.
Well, it's not over yet, you know, and also the program changes are going to recur. This is not the last. This is the start of program changes.
Right, but
they're
going to
be going on for a long time.
The way you go about it, it's like it's a suicide mission. But let me share a wonderful book that whatever time you're given, Jim, I hope you consider bringing on the author. It's called Homo Sapiens with an E. The author is Aeolus, A-E-O-L-U-S, and the last name is K-E-P-H-A-S. And I'm going to just briefly share, probably I should just read from the back. It's an occult history. Your conversation with Veronica made me feel that this would be right on time for speculative fiction, etc. An occult history of DNA from Eden to Armageddon. Homo Sapiens investigates the millennia-long psyop known as culture and the various socio-religious systems of worship that have shaped and directed humanity's evolution until now. Mapping a flow of archetypes, beliefs, and practices from ancient Egypt through the, I'm going to shorten some, through the Moses and the Israelites, Ministry of Christ, Gnostic movement, and the inception of Christianity. Aleister Crowley's Law of Thelema, Hitler, and the National Socialists, and finally the UFO contact cults and alien abduction rituals of modern times. The book unveils an occult agenda behind history and the mythic narrative of Masonic sorcery theater that drives it, drawing on the works of Jung, Steiner, Philip K. Dick. This work interprets all human and even transhuman manipulations as side effects of an even deeper process of DNA activation, kundalini rising, and species mutation.
Okay.
A grimoire for the end times, and he talks about the lack of the goddess.
Well, it sounds very interesting, but I'll point out one problem why it isn't right for me. It's not fiction.
But it's how people come about creating fiction. And the basic...
That's an interesting premise. Yeah.
Is that without the goddess in all these patriarchal belief systems, paradigms, you must create the devil. And so he speaks on the return of the goddess, which I think Margot's proud. I was hoping if she, maybe when she does come to your show as a guest, I was hoping because a lot of Coast to Coast listeners, you know, they're very much more familiar with Wicca than they ordinarily would be. They have several witches on of different traditions, so I'm hoping that Margot might share that with us. And one of his themes is that the intellectualism of our world is without the goddess feeling.
Okay, I want to thank you. It's great. I want to move on, but you know, I have 15 minutes left to a 38-year career.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Take care.
Good morning. Okay. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
Good morning, Margot and Jim.
Hi.
I just thought of something a few moments ago about the imperfections of radio and the beauty inherent in those imperfections. And I was thinking, I really think that radio programs like trains shouldn't run completely on time. And therein is part of the beauty. And one of the things I miss about BAI from years ago
is the inexactitude of broadcasting.
Exactly. And in addition to that, sometimes radio, some of the programs would bleed into each other and there would be overlap and interaction. I don't mean like today, like the few seconds where someone's off mic and saying, hey, you know, I just dropped my coffee and nice show, and then, you know, welcome in the next person. There was an organic sort of exchange, and it wasn't this rigid, you know, chronologically mandated format where everybody had to get off.
Yeah, Fass would come in and, I mean, he would be, I would come in at 5 a.m., Fass would still be on, and it would bleed into the next, with the exception, of course, of Julius Lester and Larry Josephson, where it had to happen at 7 a.m. But I'll tell you why that can't happen anymore.
I know what you're going to say, but for those who don't know, you can say it.
The webcast.
Yeah.
Because if somebody wants to listen to Hour of the Wolf or whatever, or As I Please, for whatever program they want, and they go to the WBAI archive to listen to it in the webcast, that's an automated thing, and it's going to go on at 5 a.m. So if the previous show is running over, or whatever, they'll be hearing the wrong thing when they click on that, if they, you know, with their smartphone or their computer or whatever. So very sadly, that fabulous flow of one program into another doesn't work when we're trying to reach people through the internet.
Sure, that makes sense.
Through time sharing, yeah.
I want to say one more quick thing. I was also thinking about you know, that analogy with baseball, that, you know, like there's no crying in baseball. There's often no subjectivity in NPR. Juan, oops, you know. So,
well, that's a whole other. That was just stupid.
Right.
Well, I mean, we can talk.
About,
we can talk about that, but anyway, that's a whole other story.
Yeah, that's a whole other bag of worms. But anyway, I hope everything works out well, and I don't want to say that change is automatically good, because that's so trivial and trite, and history bears that to not be necessarily true. I mean, history in the big, greater scope of things. I'm talking about, you know,
gotcha.
We all. But wherever you guys land, or whatever you keep on doing and be well and all that stuff.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Take care.
You. That's great. Bye-bye. And good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Jennifer. This is Bobson of Bulgaria.
Good morning. How are things in Bulgaria today?
Uncomfortably hot the past few days for November, but other than that, it's sunny, and I'm not looking out through the window too much, but I'm listening to your show, and I wanted to tell you how displeased I was to find out last week that Hour of the Wolf has been mistimed. But one thing you can... Well, that much I gathered, but one thing you can think about is that it's always the Hour of the Wolf somewhere around the planet.
That's wonderful, and particularly if you're in... What time is it in Bulgaria right now?
Well, it's approaching 2 p.m. of Saturday, November 13th.
So with the internet and with Skype and with everything else, I guess the time is less important than it was, maybe.
Well, I was...
Because you'll always have people calling from 5 a.m. somewhere.
That's true.
I was thinking that if the 7 a.m. slot is where Hour of the Wolf moves, it's the Hour of the Wolf in Colorado, and if I was a wolf, I would much rather be living in Colorado than New York City.
That's wonderful. That's totally wonderful. That's a whole new way of looking at it. I really appreciate what you've said. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Margot Adler. I had a great year since I started listening regularly to Jim's show. And what I wanted to find out is, how would one know what you, Jim, are doing next week on WBA?
I don't know. So I can't say. Probably the best thing would be to visit my website, ourwolf.com. Or follow my Twitter feed, Jim Freund. Or certainly, if you tune in at 7 a.m., I may be there. Somebody else may be there. Somebody will make an announcement.
And when you see Simon, give him my regards, because over the time I've started listening to his show as well, and that I will miss as well if I don't find out when.
Yeah.
You did a great Raymond Chandler reading.
Wasn't that wonderful? That's one of my favorite stories, Red Wind.
Yeah, and he did a great reading. I
He did.
Enjoyed it very much. And when you see him, give him my regards. If
I will do that.
Take care. Thank you so much.
Have a great morning, you too. Thank you too.
For
all the Hour of the Wolf shows.
Thanks so much. Take care. And good morning. You're on the radio.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Margo. I wanted to ask you an opinion about something. Even though the candidate, Christine O'Donnell, was a part of the Tea Party, I didn't like the way she was ridiculed because she may have...
Oh, because of the witch stuff?
Yeah, I wanted to get your opinion of that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I saw those episodes on Bill Maher. I saw actually most of them. And actually the one on the witch one was actually the least weird in some way as some of the other ones. There's one where she's talking about anal sex that's... I'm actually kind of surprised that I think basically just because news shows don't want to touch that they didn't, you know, that didn't sort of come out. But so I saw all of them. But, you know, the feeling I had when I watched her on those Bill Maher shows was how, you know, they were all so young. I mean, even Bill Maher, he looked sort of crazy with his hair all over the place. And he was so young and she was young. And it was kind of one of those shows where everybody was like letting everything out and saying the most ridiculous things all the time. And so in a way, I think it was a little unfair to use this as sort of, you know, her statements about the world. On the other hand, I was asked at one point by The Nation, actually, if I would write something about Christine O'Donnell and the witch stuff. And, you know, I just suddenly said, you know, I'm not going to do that. But, you know, I'm glad she lost personally, but well, I shouldn't even say that. But anyway, I mean, I don't know.
The way I see it, I mean, like the way of interest she had as a hobby, that's her interest and why she should be ridiculed having a certain interest.
That's right. No, no, no. I think the whole thing. No, but on the other hand, though, then when she made that ad, you know, I'm not a witch, I'm
right.
You. That was a little bizarre, too, you know. So I think that the original ridicule as because she says, you know, because of the witch stuff was unfair. Yeah, I do agree with that.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. Okay. So, Jim, regarding the show, definitely this show really should be at least, you know, even at the most, 90 minutes. It deserves it. It doesn't have to be 2 hours. But then again, on BAI, you have a lot of shows that are long that really deserve to be just an hour. They need to be tighter. Like particularly on Saturday, like the Irish, the IRA show. The IRA have given up. It's over. That show should be really an hour tops, not an hour and a half. There's a lot of other things to report on in the world now. It's now 2010, not 1969 anymore. So there's a lot of
this stuff is fluid. I think, you know, a lot of the changes that are going to be happening over the next few weeks will probably be changing again in the spring.
Probably, yeah.
This station, I mean, I don't like what's losing this time slot, but this station must change.
Mm-hmm.
Or it won't survive. That is a truth. That is a truth. I don't like moving out of here. I would love it if somebody said, oh, well, you know what? We've reconsidered, and you get another 38 years on Hour of the Wolf. But change of this station must occur. By the way, you know what show? I miss the 15-minute time slots we had in the late 60s. Those were tightly produced, great little things. I did a science fiction review show that was 15 minutes long. That was wonderful.
I remember doing a pagan press review at one point when I started doing paganism. And there were also a lot of political shows which were just perfect for 15 minutes, you know, something about, let's say, rent and in the city or something about, you know, there were just lots of places where you could say, look, here's what we're doing. Here's what we need. Here are the protests that are going on. Here's the things you should be interested. Here's the things you should write your Congress people about. It was perfect for a 15-minute slot.
I think some of the... live radio shows need more time. And I think that some of the produced shows, there should be more produced shows, and they should be tighter and shorter. That's my opinion.
Let's go on and take another call, but thank you so much.
Thanks.
Okay, have a great morning. Take care. Hi there, you're on the radio.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Ms. Adler. It's absolutely wonderful that I did finally get to hear you on the air.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
And listen, I want to say, above all things, you guys, I know, Jim, that you're very involved in radio drama, And Ms. Adler, I don't know if you've ever...
It's Margo. It's Margo, by the way.
Okay, Margo. If you have ever acted or done anything, you guys could do a great Holmes and Watson, because that's the vibe I get from you. It would be great. There's at least one work where Holmes is explicitly written as a woman, and
that's
there's
right.
a whole line of, like, the great game of, like, fan interpretation where people actually believe that Holmes was a woman in drag as a man, you know, in playing a trousers role.
Well, God knows Basil Rathbone did that a couple of times, yeah.
There you go. I mean, you know, I don't know. You know, I think we could at least convince people that you're descended from Irene Adler, a fictional character albeit, but who knows? Alternate universes abound. So.
That's right. That's right. Well, thank you.
Listen, any time you guys can be on the air together, it is very enjoyable.
I must
very
say.
Enjoyable.
Thank
so
you
I
so much.
Thank you. And listen, to the last caller, this is not dirty, so you don't have to believe it, but listen, Bosh Donnacourt to you, my friend, okay? So that's, you know, icky thing that he said. I didn't like it. But listen, enjoy the show. Looking forward to it wherever it lands, and hope to hear from you again. Thanks, Margo.
So do we want to go on, or what do we want to do?
Well, let's see. At 6:50, you know, so it's sort of, normally I would put on my outro theme.
But you don't want to do that. And anyway, we haven't even talked about all the other stuff either.
That's right. So should we start talking about the other stuff?
Maybe we should, and then we take some calls later. Or
yeah, well, we could play another cut of music just for a little brief break.
I'm up to whatever you want to do.
I think, you know, music is the sorbet of live radio.
Okay.
You know, it gives a little break.
So the amuse-bouche, as they say.
Ah, yes, indeed.
The amuse-bouche.
Exactly. So in the post-bouche era, or whatever, here is a cut of music from Catherine Tickell. Thank you. This is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio at 99.5 FM.
And this is Hour of the Wolf, and it's going to continue, even though it's 5 of 7. It's going to continue, yeah, apparently, well, till 8:30.
Yeah.
And this is Margo Adler, creator, once founder. Founder and creator of Hour of the Wolf.
Always founder of Hour of the
founder,
Wolf.
Founder of Hour of the Wolf in 1972.
I should explain that usually when I go on till 8:30, we call the show Why the Wolf Hasn't Come, because Simon's original show was Why the Revolution Hadn't Come.
Oh, Why the Wolf Hasn't Come.
So, yeah, indeed,
yes,
ouch.
Yes, yes.
So when so when I fill in for Simon, or mm-hmm. he fills in for me, we use that title.
Oh, that's great. That's
so great. It is Hour of the Wolf, and the last one in its time slot. And even then, it is really sort of coming to an end because, well, the Hour of the Wolf, on the one hand, it's past. It's after dawn.
Yes.
And Hour of the Wolf ends with the dawn.
Yes. Yes.
By the Varg team and by the original concept of Hour of the Wolf. On the other hand, as that caller pointed out so wonderfully.
Yes. It's always
Hour of the Wolf
time somewhere. Yes.
And that is a wonderful
thought. Isn't that a great thought?
It's a great thought to go out with.
Yes, as a matter of fact, he's right. It's beginning to be Hour of the Wolf in Mountain Time, going to be.
That's right.
And then it's going to be Hour of the Wolf time in the West Coast.
Indeed.
It's great.
Indeed.
It's great.
And because we're broadcast or webcast through the internet.
Right.
As evidenced by a phone call from Bulgaria.
Right.
We now do have this worldwide reach.
Wonderful.
So that is the justification by which I will continue to use the title Hour of the Wolf wherever the powers that be here deem to place me.
Wonderful.
That's the justification I'm going to use, that it's always Hour of the Wolf somewhere. But having said that, this is the end of this program in the time slot that Margot created in 1972, and it has been special.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I will say that I made the slot my own, but it was in a space that you created. And, you know, words don't say it. Although it's radio, so words are all we have to go by, mm-hmm. as Shakespeare mm-hmm. once said. But
yeah, and I would actually say that in a certain odd way, this was and is a sacred space.
Very much so. Very much so. And while I will continue on the air, and we will continue on the air until 8:30.
Soon we will be, so we can sort of say, we are going to a sacred space. No, yes, we are going to a sacred place. We are in sacred space. We are living in a state of grace. We are loving in a sacred way.
Is that one of the chants?
That's one of my millions of chants. I forget who wrote that one, but they all actually have authors. They're really wonderful. Some
yeah.
Some of them are really beautiful. Anyway,
so from the weepiness to some really dark stuff, huh?
Not dark. Not dark the way I do it.
Well, yeah, not the
way
you.
I'm not in a dark spot.
You see, this is where I wouldn't say that we part company, but you see, I don't go in. Now, one of my favorite guests and one of my favorite people in the world is Terrence Taylor, who's a great writer of vampire books. And Bite Marks is the first in his.
And that is a pretty gory book, I will say.
It is a pretty gory book. And I don't easily watch gory movies. In fact, I generally don't watch gory movies, even when they're really good films. And there's some really interesting films.
You know, there's what I call science fiction gory films, and then there are gory films. And I find that it's really different when it's a science fictional film. For example, the one I'm thinking about with the governator in it, with the woman with three breasts. What is this?
Total Recall?
Total Recall. Total Recall probably has 200 people killed in one scene, and yet I walked away from that thinking it's not a violent film at all, because it's that kind of science fictional violence, whereas some of the sort of the really violent stuff, like, I'm just thinking of some of these, they're not science fictional at all, some of these sort of more true crime kind of films that are considered really, I mean, there's some, I guess my, you know, the bottom line for me is redemption. If there's redemption in a story, it's fabulous. So, for example, No Country for Old Men, I couldn't deal with it.
Right.
I couldn't deal with it because there's no redemption at all, you know? And so I have a very different attitude toward gore, I would say, in these kind of serious, important, no redemption type films. Whereas Total Recall, I love Total Recall. I could have seen it 20 times, and yet I suddenly, someone said to me, you know, there are about 200 people who get killed in that film. And I went, really?
Well, more ultimately, but like in one scene.
In one scene, you
yeah,
know, right?
Absolutely. science fiction writer of our acquaintance, I happen to know, is working on a story that's sort of like told by a sideline person, one of the people who's not quite but almost collateral damage in Total Recall.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's going to be a really good story when she gets around to writing.
So what we're talking around beating around the bush about here is that before
we do that,
we have to say this is WBAI at 99.5, and this is Hour of the Wolf continuing, or Beyond the Wolf, or whatever.
But what it is not is As I Please, which would be normally starting now and would be on its last normal show if it weren't for the fact that Simon is already suspended. So he can't be here this morning sharing with you. But, you know, stay tuned to WBAI for news about Simon. I believe there should be ultimately some good news about that. But if you want to see Simon yourself, go to the Swift on Monday. He just sent me an email. It's the 22nd. Oh, it's not this Monday. I made a mistake, and he made a mistake. Ha, 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 ha. It's because he made a mistake, but he just sent me an email. I'm glad I checked it. It's a week from Monday. It's a week from Monday, November 22nd. It's still opposite the Sifwa Shindig.
Right.
But a week from Monday, the 22nd, at the Swift, 34 East 4th Street. For more information, 212-260-3600 for the sermon from Moby Dick. And, you know, it's like, oh, forget that Orson Welles thing in that Gregory Peck movie that Ray Bradbury wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Watch Simon do it.
So what we were talking about is that in the last
about a year and a half.
In the last year and a half, I have read 124 vampire novels. And so I want to tell you why I've done that and why I've sort of been thinking about that. And I'm actually going to write a nonfiction book about the zeitgeist, the spirit of the times, and vampires, and why vampires at this moment in time have so much traction. So it started completely unroutinely. I was on my way to a festival and happened to be in the airport and needed a book to read. And they had this deal, you know, where you basically buy them and then can return them, you know, and just for a very little money. And I saw this paperback and I had nothing to read. And I said, what the heck? You know, I'll read the first Twilight book. So I took the first Twilight book to Florida and was reading it at this festival. And I have to tell you, I had never, the only vampire interest I had ever previously had, I guess I had read The Vampire Lestat, and I'd read maybe Interview of the Vampire a long time ago, and I'd read Whitley Strieber's The Hunger, and had seen the movie The Hunger. And I have to say that that incredible movie with Catherine Deneuve and, you know, and Susan Sarandon and David Bowie, I thought was amazing. I even had a couple of fantasy moments, I will admit, putting myself in various of the characters in that movie. But except for that, except for having read The Hunger and seen The Hunger, except for having maybe read, you know, a Rice novel or two, I had never had any interest whatsoever in vampires. So I read the first Twilight novel, and you know, I got sort of hooked into the plot or whatever, and I returned it to the airport and picked up the second one, and went home. And 10 days later, my husband got diagnosed with serious stomach cancer, stage 4 stomach cancer, and was sick for the next 9 months and then died. And during the time that I was taking care of him, and I stopped work, I worked maybe 2 days a week instead of regularly, went on family medical leave, was taking care of him and sitting by his bedside, and he was going through chemo and radiation and all kinds of other horrible things. And during that period, I needed a couple of escapes. So I started walking around the reservoir 5 miles a day. That was one of my escapes. And my other escape was I sort of obsessively started reading vampire novels. And, you know, I went from the Twilight novels to all the Sookie Stackhouse novels. And then I read the two sequels to Strieber's The Hunger. And then I went on and on and on. I just started almost obsessively, of course. I went back and I read, you know, Bram Stoker's Dracula, and I read Interview with a Vampire, and I read, you know, but then I went on and on and on and read all the teen novels. I read the detective novels that, I read some of the, you know, there's all this African American vampire fiction. There's near porn. I mean, we can go on and on. I'll give you my annotated list at some point later in the show. I mean, there's some amazing, and there's actually some really amazingly beautiful stuff. There are what I would call very literary coming of age novels. There's a woman named Susan Hubbard, who's written The Society of S, The Year of Disappearances, and The Season of Risk. There's an amazing book by Michael Talbot, the guy who wrote The Holographic Universe, who's now deceased, and he wrote a book called The Delicate Dependency. It's out of print. It's a very strange but wonderful vampire novel. There are all these teen nerdy vampire novels which turn the genre on its head, such as one called it, one fabulous novel by Kimberly Pauley called Sucks to Be Me, with the sequel Still Sucks to Be Me. And all these sort of pimply, you know, like kids who get turned to be vampires when they're 15.
Well, Veronica Shaines, who I mentioned last week, wrote one, you know, where a 15-year-old girl is turned into a vampire, and it's like, you know, why couldn't it have happened until my acne went away?
Well, exactly. You know? That's like Suck It Up is like that. Now, I haven't read that one. I'll have to read it. You'll have to tell me what the title is.
It hasn't published yet.
Oh, it isn't. Well, there's another one already out like that.
I'm not sure if she sold it.
There's already one out called Suck It Up, which is about a 15-year-old boy with acne. It's the same idea. And it's a very, very good book. And then there's some just fabulous series. There's a series called the House of Night series, which is completely Wiccan, totally Wiccan, by a mother. Mother-daughter pair, basically, from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Anyway, it goes on and on. So I started obsessively reading these books.
And let's mention Elia Johnson, who's on
well,
the show.
Well, I read, I read Moonshine, Elia Johnson's book, and it went on and on and on. So anyway, I started obsessively reading these books. And as I was reading these books, I kept on saying to myself, so why am I doing this? What is going on here? Why am I completely obsessed by this? And I was becoming totally obsessed by vampire novels. And I have to say that I was not, to get back to the sort of original point that Jim had mentioned, I was not really obsessed by the horror ones. I had a lot of issues about, I mean, Let the Right One In is very interesting, the Swedish novel, and the Swedish movie is very, very interesting. But quite frankly, books like The Passage or The Strain, books that essentially have the vampires as what I would call non-conscious monsters. Sort of in The Strain, they're completely unconscious. In The Passage, they're pretty barely conscious. I find those not interesting at all. I want my vampires to be conscious and struggling with moral issues, which I think is actually, I'm going to get to this in a minute, which I think is actually the most interesting thing about vampire novels, is that they are struggling with moral questions, and the moral questions that, in fact, we are struggling with right now. So I started thinking to myself, okay, why is this happening? And the first thing that was obvious was that I was meditating on mortality. I was watching my husband, you know, be sick, and the question of dying. And my husband was, how would I put this? My husband was one of these people who was, we had both read 1,000 science fiction novels when we had met. And he has what I would call the science fictional high-tech view of death, which was that he was going to defeat it at any cost, that he took all these supplements, he was in perfect health, he was a runner, he never smoked, he never took a drug, he was like,
he actually would approach the microwave with a 10-foot pole.
Yes, exactly. He wouldn't let, when I got pregnant, he took one of those, he was looking around the house for what kind of low frequency was where and where I shouldn't go and how many hours I could spend on the computer a day, and all that. I mean, he was like, and he was like the perfect, this for this guy to get stomach cancer, particularly a kind of cancer that was mostly gotten by people who were like in Korea or Japan who had a particular diet. And he was like a wheat germ yogurt kind of salad guy, he was, maybe he ate a little chicken and stuff like that, but he was like in perfect health. He was a runner. And so this came completely out of the blue. And he was the kind of person who, if I had said that anybody was a candidate to live to be 100, he was going to be one of those people. So I realized that he had that view of death, that death was to be defeated at any cost, and that I was growing up in this pagan nature world, which had a very different view of death, which was that death is part of a natural cycle, that we, we are born, we grow, it's like, we're like the trees, there's spring, there's fall, there's winter, there's regeneration, but essentially we are like we go back into the elements, we are air, we are fire, we are earth, And I remember reading this fabulous description of the idea that, I don't even know if it's true, but it's just such a wonderful metaphor, that the way the sort of ancient notion of the elements, earth, air, water, fire, came into being was they were the ways that we go into death, that essentially we're either burned on the pyre or we're left for carrion or we go into the sea or we are buried in the earth, and that they are in fact the ways we die. So I realized there was a tension between my own view of death, which I wasn't completely at one with, because it was a part of me that was sort of into my husband's view of death and my husband's view of death. And I realized that almost every vampire novel has that tension in it, because there's the belief and the belief in the desire for immortality. And yet, as, for example, Rosalie says in one of the Twilight movies, I don't want to be this. I'm frozen. I want to have kids. I want to be part of this. She wants to be part of the cycle. And so there's this tension, I think, in a lot of vampire novels between immortality as good and being wanting to be part of the cycle of life. Immortality is not good. So that was clearly the beginning. But I said, no, that's not. I don't buy that's the reason why this is happening in the society, why all these people, both teens and adults, are reading all these books. It's not about death. And it's also, I don't think it's about sex. All these articles are saying it's all about sex. It's all about, Twilight is all about, repressed sexuality and abstinence and all this kind of stuff. And I said, well, I don't think so. I don't think so. Particularly if you look at the last movie, the last Twilight movie, at the very end, Bella says, as she's with Edward in this loving, she suddenly says, you think this is about you. It's not about you. It's about me and the choices I want to make. Mm. And I realize Bella, an only child of divorce like me, was basically from a middle class family that was pretty nothing. I mean, her father was a cop, her mother, and she's making this choice between extended families that are like tribal and working class versus upper class. I mean, she's trying to choose who the heck she is. And that's what teens are trying to do. They're trying to figure out who their, what their identity is, what their choice is. And also, let's face it, every single teen, if I wanted to say, what was I into when I was a teenager and what am I still into way down deep now in my fantasies, is I'm really identifying with the persecuted other. Mm. The persecuted other, which is like the X-Men or whatever you want to say. Mm-hmm. The persecuted other, that person who is not understood by society, the stranger in a strange land, vampire novels fit really into that. But it still isn't explaining everything to me. I still don't get why this is happening. So then I went to academics and I started talking to academics about, who were studying vampires and folklore and studying the movies and studying the literature. And one thing became very, very clear. I actually did a piece about this for NPR, that the waves of interest in vampires, never been fads, but there have been waves, and the waves have often lasted a decade. And those waves have always happened as a result of a particular fear and concern. So, give you two examples. 1816, first vampire novel in the English language. Where does it happen? Same chalet, same weekend, Mary Shelley writes Frankenstein.
And 19-year-old Mary Shelley.
Right. And so Polidori writes this first vampire novel story in the English language. What's happening? What's the fear of concern in that chalet? Science playing God. You know, all the stuff that was happening that resulted in both that vampire novel and Frankenstein.
Both science fiction and horror invented that weekend.
That weekend. Right. Exactly. Then, okay, 1897, Bram Stoker writes Dracula. What's happening? England has the largest ports in the world. It is essentially frightened to death of disease and immigration coming into its shores. So you have this Eastern European character bringing dirt from a foreign land, right? You know, perfect mirroring of fears and concerns. So you can go through this and you can look at the Anne Rice period and everything, and you could look at AIDS and what's happening in that, et cetera. So I started looking at that, and then I said, well, okay, but what's happening now? And I started looking at the vampires that were most popular in our culture right now. So you've got Edward Cullen and the whole Cullen family. Mm-hmm. You've got Bill Compton in True Blood. You've got Henry Fitzroy in the Tanya Huff novels. Very interesting. These are beautiful detective novels, by the way, in which there's this incredible tension between Victoria